Nashe was a Spanish actor, writer, director,
Inside
producer,
company,
who made well over
100
feature films in Spain
Klimovsky's
and specialized in fantasy and horror.
So always outdoes everybody, outdoes Christopher Lee, outdoes Boris Karloff, and in playing all of these characters, to everybody from Jack the Ripper to the Hunchback, to, I mean, Paul played all of them.
Paul was a Spanish icon. You know, he was different again.
He was a child of the Spanish Civil War. And he grew up tough. And yet, it put inside him some kind of a sense of humor where he could look at the world with a twinkle in his eye and really understand what was going on behind things.
Many people are inspired by something they see as a kid, whether it's a painting or a book. I mean, for instance, Ray Harryhausen saw King Kong, Grauman's Chinese Theater, in its first release, and it gave him his career, his life's work. I saw Seventh Voyage of Sinbad in a theater in Los Angeles when I was 8, and I just went crazy. I said, who does that? My mom said, the director. So gave me my life's work. And Paul Nashe saw Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, and that inspired him. But almost everyone has some epiphany.
To little Jacinto Molina, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman was a magical movie. And it formed, I think, the basis for his ethos of the kind of pictures that he eventually wanted to make and play.
He has a big following. He had a really, you know, huge following kind of worldwide. When I go to shows, conventions in the States, they always ask me, you know, how was it to work with Paul? I think his work was wonderful. So many directors, especially American directors, look to his work. You have Tarantino, Joe Dante, John Landis. I mean, so many people that know and knew and know and loved his work and followed his work.
He was something of a celebrity. When I made The Howling, I named all the characters, a lot of the characters, after werewolf movie directors, and I named one after Paul, Jack Molina, because Jacinto Molina was his real name.
And I just have a lot of respect, honestly, for anyone who makes 100 films. It's amazing. People don't realize how hard it is to get the money and then to actually produce a movie. I mean, the odds are against you. So to be that prolific is very impressive. I was asked by the organizers, they said, would you present a Time Machine Award to a Spanish actor? And I said, well, who? They said, Paul Nashe. I said, Paul Nashe, of course. So I did, and it was an honor for me because I liked it that he was getting an award in Spain. Very often, artists are not recognized in their own countries. So, I mean, I was with Fellini in Rome. I was with Kurosawa, Sajid Ray, one of the great artists. You know, Indians didn't like his pictures. He's the best, like the world-class artist from India. They didn't like his movies. So, you know, it's difficult. So I like it because Paul was always a commercial player. He was never properly recognized in Spain. So I was very pleased to present him with this award. I'm delighted.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 37 of the Nashe Cast. I am one of your hosts, Rod Barnett.
That would make me the other host, Troy Gwynn.
And we are here for episode number 37, if we are counting. We're having to use everybody's fingers and toes this time around to get this.
Yeah, we are.
To get this right.
I know there was some controversy over what number episode this was, but
what the hell number was it? Yes, last episode was 36.5. That means this one kind of has to be number 37.
Mm-hmm.
Although, for the first time for one of our regularly numbered podcasts, we are not covering a film starring Paul Nashe. Not a fiction film, anyway. This
right.
is a documentary, the first documentary that we have covered. And that takes us into uncharted territory for the Nashe Cast. But hey, we can manage it. It's it's a good time, and I think everybody will enjoy it.
Yeah. Everybody's been waiting for this one for a long time. You know, I know all Nashe fans are very happy that this is starting to at least be accessible. This particular
one way
documentary,
or another, yeah.
Yeah, one way or the other, get your hands on it.
Before we delve into a bit of a discussion on this documentary, let's talk first about a couple of things. First, let's start at the end and work our way backwards. Mm-hmm. The end of the show, I'm going to put a song on here from a band called the Screamin' Witch Doctors. That's Screamin' with no G.
Mm-hmm.
That I can find very little information about. So I'm going to hold off on trying to fill you in on just what this band is about and where they're from and all this kind of stuff, because I'm still hunting for information about them, honestly. But the great thing is I stumbled across them because I stumbled across them on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've done a tribute song to Paul Naschy.
Yeah.
And Very cool. I'm going to put that at the end of this. Awesome. I'm going to put that at the end of this episode and let you guys check this out. I think the song is great. And what's wild is you'll hear the lyrics, them talking about Valdemar Daninsky and quite a few other things. Let's just say that I think if you're a Naschy fan, you're going to enjoy this tune from the Screamin' Witch Doctors. So that'll be at the end of the show. Also, just a few things.
This is our memento episode. Now we're going to be working our way, backwards because we're going. Yeah.
That brings us to the next two things, which is we're going to mark two things that are kind of passages, I guess you should say. Our good friend of the show, Brother D, and his wife Brenda or Bryn, have called a halt after 5 years to Mail Order Zombie, the podcast Mail Order Zombie. Good old MOZ is. Going to start pushing up daisies, yeah, instead of shambling after those of us still breathing and running around.
Mm-hmm.
So MOZ is going to call it quits. I think they've got about one more episode before they close the doors and lock them and bolt them and keep the damn zombies outside forever. And that's a sad thing, but at the same time, they've done it for 5 years.
I know. I was about to say, it's a hell of a run. Yeah, and doing it pretty much, what, every week, right? Not just like...
Well, they took a couple of... they took a couple of breaks, a few hiatus points in the past few years to kind of give themselves a breather. And there for a while, they were doing it every week for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And since they've come back, they've been doing it every other week. But they've decided, well, I guess Derek has basically said, you know, I think I've reviewed enough damn zombie movies. And he's apparently reviewed well over 200. Having intimate knowledge of just how low quality a good number of that 200 is.
Wow. Yeah, that's the veritable sifting through the dirt to get to the nuggets of gold kind of analogy that, you know,
in a barnyard where the chickens crap a lot. Yeah. Let's put it that way. So better he than I,
mm-hmm, yeah,
is basically, yeah, how I've always kind of felt about that. But Brother D and Miss Brenner are closing up shop at MOZ, and that is a sad thing, but it's not as if Brother D is going to stop podcasting.
He's got another one going that's been very, very good.
1951 Down Place, along with his two co-hosts. Great Hammer podcast. Mm-hmm. They tackle one film a month, and it gives them time to delve heavily into each film with a lot of notes and information, something that I admire a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there aren't nearly enough podcasts like that out there. There are a lot of podcasts that kind of take this glancing view of certain films and do it on a regular basis. And those are great, and they're wonderful in their own way, but more informative, really, really in-depth podcasts about these films, I think, are few and far between. And the ones that are out there, I truly love. And so 1951 Down Place, if you're a Hammer fan, it and Terror Transmission are the go-to, heavy-duty, high-quality, deep information podcast for me for this. I think that they're great shows. And apparently Brother D claims he's got some other tricks up his sleeves, so he will continue to podcast. We do not know quite what yet, but I'm sure it will be exciting, interesting, and something that I will enjoy whenever it comes to fruition. So goodbye to Mail Order Zombie. Please don't take the locked doors and the boarded up windows badly.
Brother D is dead. Long live Brother D.
True. The other passing that I think we need to acknowledge is because we do cover Spanish horror, and it is our chosen point of reference for this podcast, we do have to take note of the fact that Jess Franco did pass away just a couple of weeks ago.
Yep.
As we speak, I think just today as we're recording this, Horror Rises from Spain has put up a tribute podcast to Jess Franco and his work. I know Elena elicited many folks to contribute to that. Yeah. I recorded the day of his death, I recorded a brief I don't know, I guess you'd call it remembrance of my feelings about Jess Franco and about his passing, and sent that in. So that'll be a part of the show. And it's a sad thing. I don't think any of us are at all surprised. It's not as if Jess Franco wasn't getting up in years. And I think with last year's passing of
Lena,
of his beloved Lena, it's not not unsurprising, not too much of a shock.
No, you can't say he didn't live a full life. Can't say that he didn't get to live a life of getting to express himself. And that was that's a pretty valuable thing for anybody to be able to do. And so he got to do it pretty much consistently. And that's what he lived for. He got to do what he wanted to do. And, you know, that's a pretty impressive thing, pretty inspiring thing.
He certainly lived life by his own by his own rules, and he
made his art by his own rules. And
exactly, and that's something I just think that yes, it is sad that Jess Franco's gone, and of course we will miss him. But at the same time, his films live on.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of shocked a couple of months ago when I got my hands on a Blu-ray of a Jess Franco film.
Yeah.
And I would never have believed that that would be A, possible, or B, likely. So so to say goodbye to him, we also say hello, because there'll always be a Jess Franco film that I have not yet seen.
I don't think we'll ever complete. I don't think you can ever see everything Jess Franco did.
Maybe Tim Lucas has or maybe will. Maybe Tim will. I don't know.
Yeah,
but Tim possibly. Maybe a few other fanatics who go way, way, way out of their way. Maybe David Z.
Yeah,
I think he's definitely working on it. David Z posted on his blog the other day. He sought out this unreleased Jess Franco film that's available in chunks on YouTube.
Really?
It was never apparently edited. It's never been released, but there's like this 2-hour work print of it in chunks on YouTube. And so he wrote up a big blog. He watched it all.
Oh, wow.
And wrote up a blog posting about it. Now I can't remember the name of the damn film. But it's just utterly fascinating. Ever since since Franco passed away, David Z spent about a week or two just throwing himself into Jess Franco blogging, and it's been truly amazing. If you haven't checked out Tomb It May Concern, that's
T-O-M-B.
T-O-M-B. Tomb It May Concern. And if you haven't checked that out, check it out. And if you're a Jess Franco fan or just curious about what somebody like David Zuzelko might get up to in his mourning of the passing of Jess Franco, then you really ought to kind of check it out. It's worth your time. Because he'll go places I'm not willing to go.
Yeah. Well, you know, I believe I'm sure we'll be delving into more Franco territory as we go further in our, as we do our spinoff and our 0.5 episodes. And, you know, as we have to start thinking of life beyond our main Nashy cast before long, you know, as you know.
Well, I think you and I need to kind of behind the scenes without the mics on. I think maybe we ought to start thinking about covering another Jess Franco film at least one more before the end of the year, and possibly two.
Sure.
Just because I've watched since his passing, I've watched a couple that I've had sitting on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
I've enjoyed them,
mm-hmm.
But they are Franco films, and therefore not just worthy of discussion, worthy of head scratching. So,
I'm sure.
I think we could just pledge now to the Nashy Cast listeners that there'll probably be a couple of special Jess Franco episodes coming your way before the end of 2013. Not really as a tribute to him, but just we've done three Franco films already as part of the podcast, so this would just be a continuation of that.
That's right.
Delving a little bit further into his filmography. Maybe we go back to one of the 60s films. I don't think we've not covered Awful Dr. Orloff or...
Right, I love that.
Yeah, we've not... There's a lot of stuff to cover and a lot of different... I like Mansion of the Living Dead, too, from the 80s, but a lot of people have covered... Slasher podcasts cover Bloody Moon.
Yeah.
Which is... It's not a good film, but it is a fun film, but... Nevertheless, we mourn the passing of Jess Franco. He lived an amazing life, and we are glad we got to know him through his films.
Yes.
Well, folks, I guess we'll take a quick break, come back, and we will discuss The Man Who Saw Frankenstein Cry.
The German school Jacinto attended left an important mark on him. It was there that he became a famous athlete. He began with soccer, but that career was frustrated by serious physical injury. After that, he became an amateur boxer, then a wrestler, and finally a weightlifter, a discipline that turned him into a renowned sports figure. He won the Spanish championship 6 times and signed on to the Real Madrid weightlifting section, where he shared the gym with soccer legends such as Di Stefano and Gento.
All right, The Man Who Saw Frankenstein Cry. Official release date on this is 2010. It's a 75-minute feature documentary about the life and work of Paul Naschy. Difficult to... We obviously aren't going to do a scene-by-scene thing in this because it's a documentary and that's right. Kind of ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think what we'll probably do is... I'll say this. Mm. The film covers the life and work of Jacinto Molina.
Mm-hmm.
From his childhood all the way up to his passing away, delves into his entire film career.
Mm. Doesn't really go too much in depth on each film. It mentions the films. It's not a documentary. It doesn't really examine or say anything too much about each film, other than just kind of mention some of the ones that he made at this particular point.
And
there's a couple that it actually goes a little bit behind the scenes or have people actually comment on, but not to any great depth on any of them.
Well, the ones that get commented on more than average are the ones that you would expect, like his like the first werewolf film and the difficulties of getting it made and the details of that, which is always something that is fascinating. And then a few of the things here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they spend a good deal of time talking about the passing of Generalissimo Franco.
Right.
What that meant, how that changed things. Mm-hmm. His Naschy's Japanese dealings. Mm-hmm. We get a little bit more information about that.
Right.
And in general, we just get a lot of information that kind of is a neat overview. I don't really think that, except for a couple of spots, you and I get a bit of get a lot of information. I don't think we get a lot of new information.
Right. Not if you're somebody who's read his book and who's read a lot of, kept up with, pretty much anything we could get our hands on to read as far as it covers his career, interviews, and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Although there are a couple of surprises in there.
There are. And it's, let's just go and say right now, it's a very lovingly done documentary, very impressive. Mm.
Yes, I have to say, I've watched the thing twice.
Mm.
And in both instances, it brought me to tears more than once.
Me too. I have one complaint about it. I'll get to it. One thing, very minor one. One thing that rubbed me the wrong way, and I just wanted to see if you noticed it too. But we'll get to that here in a little bit.
I have a couple of small things.
Yeah, very small. This is what I'm referring to is a very, very small thing. But I want to bring it up because I want to see if you did it too. But
go ahead.
I think the first thing that grabs you right off the bat is just holy shit! Look at all the people that got to be in this thing.
Oh, I know.
It's just
holy crap! Yeah, I mean. I expected, considering that the film was produced by a Spanish company,
mm-hmm.
that there would be a fair number of his co-stars, some of the Spanish actresses and actors who worked with him during his entire career. I expected them to be able to talk to them, and that was really exciting. It was really nice to be able to see these people years later and hear them talking about working with him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And kind of spill in some gossip and stuff here and there, which was really kind of cool. Uh-huh. What I was really shocked by I know Joe Dante's a fan.
Mm-hmm.
Director Joe Dante.
Yeah.
I know he's a fan. He obviously sat and talked with the producers of this film for a long period of time because they keep coming back to him and him talking about those movies.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize how big a fan John Landis was.
Me either. Now, that I did not realize.
I did know that he had been asked, and he had presented Naschy with the that award.
Mm-hmm.
The darn it, now I can't remember the name of the damned award. But I did know that. But he's a huge fan. But they got to talk. They talked to Caroline Monroe and
Jack Taylor,
the and Antonio Mayans, and the list just goes on and on. And it's really kind of impressive to see all these people talking about him. And I'll be honest, a part of it for me was really nice to realize, oh yeah, a lot of these folks are still alive.
Yes, I know. That was nice to see, or at least at the time of the documentary being made.
Yeah.
It's hosted by Mick Garris. And I think that's an interesting, I think I can see why they would like define, you know, well, this would be somebody that general horror fans can put a name. This is besides the people they interview that yeah. people will know, like Joe Dante and John Landis. Everybody will know him, but most horror fans will know McGarris's name, and so that's another having somebody to host that horror fans can automatically like, okay, I know who this is. You know, who might not know about Paul Naschy. Or just coming to it, that's, you know, that's probably a good choice, you know, to
agreed,
someone
agreed.
Like that.
And to be honest, I didn't know until it started that until I first watched this, I didn't know that Mick Garris was the narrator, mm-hmm. the on-screen narrator mm-hmm. of the thing. And honestly, he's very good at
he
it.
Does a very
I
good
was
job.
I was mm-hmm. really happy with his performance mm-hmm. here, and and it's obvious that he brings a lot of love for Naschy mm-hmm. to the plate as well.
Well, the thing is, the documentary format, of course, can be done almost in your sleep if you're so inclined. And what I love about this, you know, but you can tell the documentaries that are done with true love and thought because of the extra touches and just how mm-hmm. the rhythms that they're edited at. Because generally, the documentary format, again, like I said, it's talking heads blended with scenes from films, you know, and yeah. blended with images, you know, but. You know, the opening credits of this are wonderfully done.
Oh, they're beautiful. Yeah.
The scenes they choose of Naschy, you know, are just ones that I don't know. Some of the scenes will bring you to tears without even, I mean, just being yeah. in the context, you know, just the things they choose to images they choose to show from his films are just very moving a lot of times, you know. And then once again, just show somebody who's really thinking very much about the effect and emotionally what they want you to feel, and also the rhythm of the documentary. So this one is made with a lot of thought to it, I think.
Well, this is a very professionally made mm-hmm. documentary. Mm-hmm. I was really, really impressed mm-hmm. with the level of professionalism in the editing, the shooting. Mm-hmm. They ask the right questions. They elicit some really interesting responses. It's put together in an incredibly entertaining way. I honestly think that anybody coming in who knew nothing about Paul Naschy could get a real sense of entertainment out of learning about his career from this documentary. I think it's that yeah. well done.
It reminds me a lot. It makes me feel that's the way I felt about the Bob Burns documentary that Frank Dietz, you know,
yeah.
In this last year about Bob and Kathy Burns is the yeah. same way that just, you know, I mean, I showed it to a lot of my family members who didn't really necessarily know. I mean, obviously my older brother did, you know, and my younger brothers, you know, they knew, but like my dad, you know, and didn't know really much about Bob Burns, but he just found it thoroughly entertaining because of just how Bob and Kathy come off as human beings, the human story. And so I agree with you. I think people would go to this Paul Naschy. I think you could show it to somebody and I think they'd be really entertained by just the story. I mean, as we knew from reading his autobiography, we always read his autobiography, the man lived an amazing personal life and had an amazing history. And that, I mean, I think that when somebody not knowing anything about him watching the documentary will just be, probably have a jaw drop at just the things that his family and he went through just to survive. I mean, the odds of him even being alive, that he even survived his childhood, as they say, he was born, yeah. he was a child in the worst, one of the worst times in history, one of the worst places to be yeah. in history was in Spain in the Spanish Civil War.
Pure madness, and the fact that the circumstances, which I won't ruin, but just the circumstances
right.
of him actually being able to grow up with his father,
right, right,
with what went on then is just stunning,
it
really.
Is. But let's look at a couple of quotes that I just jotted down here from just the opening of the first things that you see is you see people talking about Paul Naschy. One person says he was both brave and he's probably brave or mad or both, you know, which I thought was a great,
yeah.
I think it was Jack Taylor. Might've been Jack Taylor, but one of the, people interviewed describes him, says, I think he's a kind of priest of this kind of cinema, you know, meaning
horror
cinema,
yeah.
which I thought that was great. Somebody else referred to him as a true believer, a maestro, and that they said that, films that his films were a matter of life and death to him, and I just thought that God, those are the things you get for the first. I thought those are all really, really nail it on the head. Those quotes, you know, really, really drive the point.
And in that last quote, most especially, I think points out the sheer force of will, the laser point focus and sheer drive that you have to have to do what he did in cinema,
mm-hmm.
especially, mm-hmm. well. At any time, really,
yeah.
but especially at the time that he was doing what he was doing.
Right.
His successes, his early successes made it easier for him as he went along
mm-hmm.
to a point, but it still took so much hard work. I mean, he had to suffer and focus and concentrate on mm-hmm. nothing but that at times in a way that is incredibly difficult. So It's neat to, well, I thought it was very telling listening to the pieces where they're talking to his wife, mm-hmm. and they're talking to his sons, mm-hmm. where you get this sense of how hard things were at times, mm-hmm. Both during the successes and the harder times.
Yeah.
You get a sense of how difficult things were at times, and to know that he persevered and kept going,
yeah.
even through those rough times, and still kept, you know, food on the table and a roof over his yeah. children's head through all those rough times. That's a brave or mad man, or a combination of the two. And that's true.
Well, I love the parallel draws. This I'd never thought about. It never occurred to me before was the drawing the line between him being a champion weightlifter and the way he pushed himself. Cause they literally say, you know, if he saw a weight, if something was a weight, he saw that weight and he lifted it, you know, yeah. to get it done. Yeah. And I never, because I always kind of thought of it as sort of like more of like, well, isn't that kind of a quirky, weird turn of events that somebody who looks like they're going to be a lifelong professional athlete, and that's where they first get their fame from, suddenly does this total sidestep into being an artist. I never thought about it in terms of, you know, we've all seen weightlifters and see the mental, both mental and physical preparation that they suddenly do when it comes to that moment. Of having to just, which is them and that weight.
Yeah, because it's not easy. You've right. got, there's a lot of mm-hmm. concentration that goes into accomplishing
and,
that.
And I've seen occasional times when that concentration falters, I mean, it's not pretty, you know, no, when they go to lift that. And so, but I never thought about that is like all through his life, you know, whoever's talking about it in the documentary, and once again, I don't remember who it was who specifically said it, but they're saying that it might even have been one of his sons, maybe, who said it, but it was just saying, like, you know, that's kind of how he went through life with, you know, it was if something, you know, he saw these weights of getting these films made, you know, that were these massive weights, and he lifted them, he just got them, you know, he pushed through them, you know, and I thought that was a really neat parallel to draw there.
Inside the production company, Paul suggested a brilliant alternative that helped fulfill Klimovsky's increasingly complicated agenda. So the schedule would be filled out by no other than his own assistant director, Carlos Orrid. If the union between Nashi and Klimovsky had produced important titles to European horror, Nashi's work with Orrid would be equally noteworthy, unleashing such films as Horror Rises from the Tomb, a curious Spanish giallo called The Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll, and two important works outside Profilmus, the Walpurgis Night sequel, and The Mummy's Revenge, a film that allowed Nashi to transfer his childhood passion for ancient Egypt to the screen.
And just to clarify, just where the title of this documentary comes from is once again, yeah. So what we're talking about with Nashi, I think, I guess he was he a child or a teenager? But I know his family visited the set of a film. Right, that Boris Karloff was
I believe it was actually an episode of I Spy that was
that's
filming.
Right, that's right. That in Boris Spain. Karloff yeah. was in Spain. Yeah. They visited the set, and of course, Karloff's health was greatly faltering by this point. You know,
this would have been the mid '60s.
Yeah. So, and he was in his last few years, and Paul Nashi witnessed, or young Jacinto Molina witnessed Boris Karloff. When they were between filming, between takes, he saw that it was a day that shoot that was going particularly long, and so it was as it was going on, his health, I mean, he was feeling worse and worse,
yeah.
and he actually saw Boris Karloff have tears in his eyes, you know, because of the physical pains he was under, and Jacinto Molina was the only one that saw that. It was just a kind of a private moment where he witnessed this that nobody else saw. But you can imagine how that stuck with him too, in his career as an artist. You know, of realizing, kind of getting an early scene right there that like this can be what, if you choose to live this kind of life, you know, this can be what awaits you. But this also is a sign of courage in what you do to push through it. Because Boris Karloff, when the cameras were rolling, he was always 100% on. You know, they talked about how you wouldn't see his pain until after the cameras turned off. You know, and I think that probably was an early thing for him to see that Kelly carried him through as an artist through his struggles later on, you know, probably that memory of, you know, that this is what you sacrifice, you know, but this is the courage you have to show
to accomplish this. And something that I wish, and this is a small problem that I have with the film, because I think it's something that, as you speak about it there, a lot of people who know Karloff's life and his approach to his work would recognize within Paul Naschy, a parallel there that I wish the film had definitely drawn, which is that Karloff never stopped working.
Right, right.
Karloff died with a script in his hand.
Yeah.
Almost literally, that is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
He worked up until the day he died. He kept going. He was looking for, when he passed away, he was already looking forward to the next project he was going to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
The same is true of Paul Naschy.
Right.
He was working up until he passed away. And that parallel between Karloff and Naschy, I think, is one that I wish the film had drawn a clearer line between the two of them and that particular fact about their ends.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the little problems I have with the film, just a tiny problem I have with it.
Yeah.
The fact that, well, that and giving it that title and not having someone on screen explaining that.
Yeah, that was a little odd to me that it really waits until the closing credits to tell you that.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, I think my choice would have been a little different. I think I would have introduced that earlier on. And
or midway through.
Or at least, first, but something more. Yeah, I thought that was kind of an interesting choice to save it, and yeah, I would have done that a little differently, I think. So I definitely agree with you on that.
But that is one of the few problems I had with the film. Okay. I mean, and the other little problems I have with it are incredibly minor.
Yeah,
you claim here's to have
my
a couple,
here's so. here's my main, and again, it's a very very minor one, but it's one that I just wondered if it affected you or if other Naschy fans if have noticed this, but. Again, we said they don't comment much on the films at all. You know, many of them, they just say the title. They don't tell you. Okay, there's a part where it mentions the people who own the dark. It has one sentence to say about the people who own the dark. It describes it as a Day of the Triffids ripoff.
That irritated me. But that's just someone giving their opinion. So
it's
that's
an opinion,
right.
But I just, it's like, well, it's one of those things where, first of all, ripoff is never used in a positive, I mean, that's never a term that's used in a positive connotation. Now, if they said a film inspired by Day of the Triffids, which it probably is. I mean, I think we all would agree that there's a parallel.
Oh, to agree. I mean, to a degree, yes. But I mean, as we did that, we did a podcast about film.
Sure.
And it draws on I Am Legend. It draws on Night of the Living Dead. It draws on, and it does draw on Day of the Triffids. Yeah. I mean, yes, it does. So.
But I think my feeling was, no, and you're right. It's just the opinion of, obviously, and we haven't even said his name, Angel Agudo, I think is the name of who actually made this documentary. Agudo, yeah, Angel Agudo.
Oh, yeah.
Directed this documentary, and it may just be his opinion, and that's fine. But in a film where really they don't say, where they're not really giving opinions for the most part in the films, and I'm hearing this, and I'm thinking, like, I'd hate for somebody that'd be the first thing they've heard of People Who Own the Dark and automatically dismiss it because that film is so worth checking out.
Yeah,
you know, that film is so worth seeing, I think. So,
yeah,
that was something just like, you know, it's like, really? It's like, did you, you know, it's like, did you feel you have to say that about it? You know, come on, you know.
But, okay,
that was a tiny thing.
Now, that one did not bother me as much because, and I guess the reason it didn't bother me is that I'm used to that type of attitude toward toward Spanish horror in general.
Yeah, yeah.
And toward European horror altogether, especially from that period. I'm used to it being casually dismissed and with terms of that type.
Yeah.
So that one, I mean, I guess it just sailed right past me. I mean, it does irk me to describe it that way because that's, you know, describing it that way describes one element of the story.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's a very, yeah, very small,
Whereas, and I wouldn't call it, maybe I'm being overly generous by refusing to refer to it as a piece of ripoff cinema.
Yeah.
Maybe I am. Maybe this is true because I think it's, even if you want to describe it as ripoff cinema, I think it's a very well done movie therefore I get what you're saying.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
Okay. Yeah. What else irked you?
That's probably really, as far as anything that really stood out to me is like, I'm not saying that, I mean, I agreed with, you know, you about the, where they placed the story of the, to where the title comes from, but off the top of my head, I'm not really remembering anything else that didn't seem to flow pretty well to me. I mean,
well, I got one other small one, and the fact that I have to go this far down and, you know, have to burrow this far down into the film to find something negative to say.
Yeah, that shows you how good it is.
Will tell you how good this film is in my eyes. John Landis, in his comments, states that Naschy was in 100 films. No, he wasn't.
Yeah, actually, you know, I didn't.
I mean, I don't want to be a nitpicker.
No, but you're right. You know, I thought of that at the time when he said that, but I forgot. I didn't write it in my notes, and so it didn't stick with me that was something else where I'm just like, you know, it's like, I think you're.
He has about 100 credits if you were to look at say his IMDb page.
Right, right.
But he didn't make 100 films. Not really even close to 100 films. He made a lot of movies, don't get me wrong. But he didn't make 100 films.
No, Jess Franco, you know, he's not
exactly. He did not make 100 films. He was in a lot of movies,
yeah.
But he didn't make 100. He maybe has 100 credits, depending on how you want to count it, and that's all fine and good. But like I say, that's a pretty minor complaint.
Oh, sure,
especially in context of how Landis is essentially obviously a drooling fanboy when it comes to Paul Dashney.
I don't really
want to complain overly much, but okay.
Yeah.
I understand you're on set and you're videotaping, you know, an interview with John Landis, and he's effusive in his praise for the subject at hand. You don't want to stop him and go, Mr. Landis, he wasn't really
We shoot that again? And
he wasn't
and,
really
and
this, in
can we bring up that? Yeah. Can we shoot that again this time? Get your damn facts straight. No. Actually, I think Landis is only failing at this point is just that he hasn't listened to our podcast. I think that's really where the problem is. So if anybody out there has any way of means of reaching John Landis, I feel like, especially since he is, as you said, a drooling fanboy over Nashie, how could he not listen to our podcast? So I think he just needs to be made aware of it. And then
one thing that I think is great is I'm such a huge fan of Joe Dante, and of course I've loved every Joe Dante film I've ever seen. I've seen them all. There's only one of his films that I think actually doesn't quite work. I've gotten to meet him and shake his hand and thank him and get his autograph. The thing is now, you know what? I want to meet him again and stick a damn microphone in his face and talk to him about Paul Dashney.
I know. I did like the Carolyn Monroe part. I wonder if you picked up on this where she said, I go to conventions and people ask me about, and I'm like, I'm waiting for her to say there was in particularly these like really, really handsome guys who do this, you know, really hot, buff, supermodel guys who do this Paul Nashie podcast but anyway.
Well, that would have obviously been the other Paul Nashie or one of the other. I mean, we are only
we'd be like, who are these guys?
Honestly,
who's this in competition?
We are only one of the best five Paul Nashie podcasts out there. Yeah. So, I mean, we are easily on a good week, I think we're number 2.
Yeah, yeah.
In the Paul Nashie podcasting territory. So, that's our ranking anyway.
That's right. Number 1 in financial gains success, I think. Number 1 for most financially successful Paul Nashie podcast out there.
And that took some doing. And bank robbery.
By the way, I love the story in here where the guy's talking about his family renting these Super 8 films.
The director. Yeah, yes. The Spanish director. Yes. Cerda? I can't remember the fella's name, but yeah.
Because I thought, what a great parallel to Monster Kids in this country, renting the old or buying the old Super 8 films came out through or that were available through Famous Monsters. Now, I think the ones that offered through Famous Monsters weren't, I don't think there were any risque ones because they were more of the old classic monsters and that sort of thing. I doubt if they had the kind of things that he ended up seeing, but that's a hilarious story where he gets horrorizes from the tomb, which apparently is
totally
not
and
apparently not an ed, yeah. So that's
he and his friend had to stop it and like wait another day and then come back and try to watch it again.
Oh gosh, that's a great, but I just thought what a neat kind of Spanish version of the classic Monster Kid story of watching the old what were they, was it Castle Arts or what was the name of the company
I think it's Castle.
I think I've got Gitter the Three-Headed Monster on my shelf there. I should pull it down and see. But anyway, those were great though. That was a great story.
I thought it was great that they were able to talk to Jorge Grau.
Oh yes,
the
that
film
was
director, the man who made The Living Dead at Manchester Morgue or Let Sleeping Corpses Lie, whatever title you know the film under. And it was neat to hear his thoughts and. Javier Aguirre, the director who made two great Nashie films. He's still alive, and they talked to him. Just amazing who they got to talk to, and it's I wouldn't change a thing about this film as far as the way it flows.
Right.
But there's a part of me who cannot wait for a real DVD release of this
to see all these
to see the outtakes.
The rest of the,
to
see the, I know.
Even more of the interviews.
To see all the rest of the, yeah, to see exactly. That's what I'm like,
you
man,
know,
I want to see
there's got to be more stuff there because, I mean, this is pared down to a great feature length. A tight 75 minutes that really does a great job of telling you the story. Mm. But, man, with all those interviews, you know that there's just so much footage sitting around that wouldn't fit in or would just have lengthened this part and it didn't need to be that long. And
still no Julia Sally. Yeah, Julia, where are you? You got to just stop hiding, girl.
I was going to bring up production photos
and she's beside him, and every one of those from all his films that he did later when she co-produced with him, and you know they keep showing all these casts where they're all like waving for the camera and drinking champagne and having their cigars and stuff, and she's like right next to him, and I'm like, girl, where are you? We got to hear your stories.
I think it's sad that it's obvious that they couldn't get her to be on screen to talk about him. And I understand woman wants her privacy these days, from what I understand, and that's fine.
That's fine, but geez,
man, this would have been the perfect opportunity to just come out,
do
this, and then, you know, go back to your life, but...
If that's
going to be a complaint about the film, that's really outside the bounds of what the filmmakers could accomplish. So.
Oh yeah, and I agree. And you know, like I said, I know there's so much more. You know, I don't want to spoil. You know, in a way, we still don't want, even though this is fact, not fiction, we still don't want to spoil everything for people because there's things we want.
Oh, there's so many good things.
There's so many things we could talk about. But I do say it's some of the most moving stuff. Of course, are just. With about Nashie's wife Elvira, you know, it's just a wonderful footage of them, and her interviews are terrific, and just seems like a wonderful woman. And I love the scene of him sitting in the chair with the werewolf makeup on, and she's like sitting on the arm of the chair. I've never seen that before.
That's a beautiful photograph.
That is a classic.
Yeah,
you're
right. I think that may be a family photograph.
Yeah.
I don't know that was ever published.
Yeah.
I've never seen that before. That
pretty
was really
awesome.
Nice. Yeah. But. We don't have any information at all on when a DVD release of this will actually be available. For those with nefarious intent, the special antenna will allow you to check this thing out. Mm-hmm. All the people speaking anything other than English are subtitled, and even the people and the people speaking in English are subtitled in Spanish.
Right,
so that you can be an English speaker or a Spanish speaker, and the movie works for you either way, which is nice.
Oh, here's one more reason why it pissed me off what he said about People Who Are in the Dark.
What?
Because they're so nice to Don Glut and Fred Olen Ray and their films.
That's true.
You know, it's like, it's because it allows them to show that they loved Paul Naschy and they loved being able to make a
which
film.
Which is all
with
fine
and it doesn't go into the fact of what those, you know, what Tomb of the Werewolf turned out to be. It's like, okay, you let that slide, and you still have to give this snarky little comment about People Who Are in the Dark. But anyway, I'll stop getting out.
Yeah, but nobody points out that Tomb of the Werewolf was excrement.
No.
I agree. I agree with you.
Oh, well.
Now, just to put a cap on this, I had to really kind of look at my you know, because I rate every film that I watch.
Right.
I gave this thing a 10, man. I couldn't imagine. I mean, the little bitty problems I have with it. I wanted to fact check John Landis.
Yeah.
And I wish that they had moved the explanation for the title to somewhere other than the end of the film. Wow, really? Those aren't large complaints.
No.
This is a great documentary.
Yeah, I think so. I think it is. I can't think of anything that wouldn't make it a 10 because, again, I think it's just, it flows so well. It's about the perfect length, you know.
Yeah.
It'd be great to see a secondary documentary done someday that maybe examined the films and did more of like a critical analysis of the films or something.
Agreed.
But no, I think it's because, you know, they want people to come into this, not only just that love Paul Naschy, but they want the curious, you know, to find out and be enticed to see more of his stuff. And so I think, you know, 75 minutes is great. 60 minutes is too brief. 90 minutes, maybe some people who aren't just Naschy aficionados start to drift a little. You got it. It flows great. It was really good for me to see that convention, the footage from his American convention appearances,
because I will always...
To my grave, I will always be kicking myself for missing his two American horror convention appearances. So it was really nice to be able to at least see some footage from those. And I was like, okay, at least I can see that, you know, since I missed them. You know.
Oh, it was great to see the crowd reaction.
Oh, man, those are fantastic. Those are the parts that get you really choked up, too, is like, you know, when all the standing ovations and all that stuff. That was pretty awesome.
And the just gibbering praise from people who are just like, I really can't believe
I'm
getting to meet this man.
Yeah.
Those German fans
yeah. oh, no.
who who he was doing this signing at a bookstore in, somewhere in Germany, and these German fans were losing their shit. oh my god, I can't believe I'm in the same.
Well, the guy says like he's my god, you know, just like okay, well I probably would not go.
That's wouldn't go that
a little
far.
Extreme, but that's a Germanic, you know, that's a German story, you know. It's like he's, you know, these guys sort of walk around with Wagner playing in their head all the time, anyway. So I think it's,
careful, let us not insult the Germans again.
Yeah, I know. Right?
Jesus, is there a nationality we could not offend, please?
Well, I'm not doing my German accent, so I will spare everybody that.
God. Before I make a ministry of silly walks, because of course I just segued into the Fawlty Towers Germans episode, which put me into John Cleese, and now I'm, you know.
I followed that thread there.
I'm sure you did follow that thread. Well, folks, we're gonna both highly recommend that as soon as you can, please, if you are a fan or if you're not, if you're trying to turn somebody into a Nashy fan, find you a copy of The Man Who Saw Frankenstein Cry, show it to them, and I guarantee you that person will probably want to check out a couple of this guy's movies. Mm-hmm. That's just how good it is. So I guess we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back, and we'll dive headlong into a pretty hefty
mailbag. Yeah,
we've got a lot of mail to get through this time, so hang on, guys. We'll be back in a second.
Hammer Film Productions began in 1934, and after producing almost 200 films and television programs, the studio is still releasing and re-releasing new and classic film titles. 1951 Down Place is the podcast that brings you the story of the great Hammer films, one movie at a time. Here are your hosts, describing what Hammer means to them. First is Casey.
Hammer means the beautiful and glamorous women of Hammer horror, the engaging storytelling, and amazing period films.
Joining him is Derek.
Hammer means the incredible work of actors like Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and even Michael Ripper. The gothic storytelling, the incredible music, and the set pieces.
And finally, here's Scott.
Hammer, wasn't that an 80s cop show on ABC with David Raich?
This boy has a lot to learn. Join our hosts as they make their journey through the Hammer Films catalogue and discuss each film with critical opinion, historical facts, production notes, and other information about these classic films. 1951 Down Place can be found in iTunes or their website, www.1951downplace.com.
Wait, that was Sledgehammer.
1951 Down Place, the home of Hammer Films discussion.
Okay, before we start the mailbag, I just want to mention right quick while I'm thinking of it, to remind anyone that's in the Nashville area or the Southeast area and wants to come to Nashville on the second weekend of May, on the there's a convention here. You heard our interview with Mark Ballard, who runs the Nashville Comic and Horror Convention, and we interviewed him, played that at our last show, and just want to remind people one more time that Rod and I will be doing a podcast, not podcast, excuse me, we'll be doing a panel. We're doing a panel discussion on the Friday night, which is May the 10th, at the Preston Hotel here in Nashville at the Nashville Comic and Horror Expo. We're going to be doing an hour-long panel on Nashy, trying to get some more converts there. Now, I do want to point out, if you go to the convention's website, and we're going to try and get this corrected, they have us listed as NashyCon. Nashycast, and I want to be sure that people showing up are not expecting us, that it's going to be a promo party for some upcoming Paul Nashy convention. That would be a beautiful thing, but that's not what we're planning at this point, so we don't want to give people the wrong idea that there is a Paul Nashy.
I'm just lost in the idea of a Paul Nashy con.
I know, just thinking like, oh, the possibilities. Oh,
that would be that'd be impressive as hell, actually, but I don't think it's going
to
happen.
So. Yeah, probably. I've heard what goes on to run a convention, and I don't think I'm wired that way. I mean, I would be happy to be. I'd be happy to be on a consulting panel for a Paul Nashy con, and I'd be happy to show up and drink the beer and talk about the man. But but yeah, I'm probably not the one that's wired to actually run a convention. So.
No, I am definitely not. So
anyway, but yes, come to that on May 10th through the 12th if you can get to Nashville or if you're in the Nashville area. So anyway, I'm going to go to the mailbag here, rummage around in it, spin the wheel, see what I pull out. Ah, look, it's from Chris, our friend Chris. He says, "Hi, Rod and Troy. Troy, the Saturday Night Live gag that Chevy Chase did every week on Weekend Update was, 'This just in, Generalissimo Francisco Franco is still dead.'" So I was close. I remembered it as being still alive, but it's actually, yes, Chris is correcting me that it was actually, that's what they would say every week, was that was their ongoing joke. He said Franco died in November of 1975, just a month or so after the show began, and that was their running joke on there, was that he's still dead. So yeah, that was it. So I did not dream it, just misremembered it, but did not dream it. So He says, like you guys, I was very pleased and surprised by The Sniper. Not only was it an effective thriller that had me on the edge of my seat at the end, it was a particularly brave film to make in that place and time. Another thing I appreciated was how balanced the film was. It's easy to think of this as an anti-Franco film, but a number of elements undercut that impression. Nash's character takes great pains to stress that he is not interested in politics and that his vendetta is purely personal. Also, the anti-Franco partisans depicted in the film aren't particularly noble freedom fighters. They're happy to resort to extortion and indiscriminate bombing. Even the accident which precipitates the film's action is just that, an accident, actually caused not by Franco, but rather by perhaps the same faction that Nashi ends up dealing with later. Like you, I found the boarding house crew to be an effective microcosm of 70s Spain, representing various public attitudes and factions. All in all, I was very pleased to discover The Sniper. I never would have seen this film without the Nashi cast, so keep up the good work, guys. Thanks, Chris. We appreciate that. Yeah. And I'm glad you had that reaction to The Sniper. That was the reaction we had, and just really liked the gray areas there and the fact that it, you know, that it doesn't really take sides, you know, the fact that it kind of makes everybody, sort of just points up to the whole insanity of fanaticism in any form, you know, and just, you know, the when you put ideals and flags and symbols above human life, it's, you know, it never works in any situation.
It's The Sniper is a hell of a film, and, mm-hmm. and definitely one of the true gems and surprises that we've run across while we've been doing this show. Mm-hmm. And it's
definitely
glad to introduce that to anybody. I'm glad mm-hmm. that he was able to seek that out and get his mm-hmm. hands on it. Once again, the special antenna does its trick.
Yes, it does.
Well, what we have here is I'll pair this down to it's kind of a challenge.
Yes,
from our man in the field, Dan, our man in the field. Came up with a strange request.
Dan's apparently thinking that Dan's apparently finding us that we've been a little complacent here. He's trying to shake us, rattle our tree a little, rattle our cages.
He's going to rattle our cages a bit. His idea is that, imagine that the powers that be mm-hmm. have decided to remake a couple of Nashi films. Mm-hmm. Now, remakes are a mixed bag at best.
Yes.
But his idea is that we get the assignment. One of us picks one film and one of mm-hmm. us picks the other. Mm-hmm. We get the assignment to try to cast a classic Nashi film mm-hmm. with people from today mm-hmm. who could possibly pull the roles in the film off mm-hmm. if the movie was remade today. Mm-hmm. So, here we go.
Yes, and he assigned,
Ahead. Well, he assigned Inquisition to Troy, mm-hmm. and he assigned El Caminante to me. So what we decided to do is, Troy, this podcast, you mm-hmm. go for broke and mm-hmm. give us your impressions of what would be necessary, because he's saying this, you've got carte blanche, don't think about price, don't think about the
right,
just whoever you want. How would you cast Inquisition? And next month I will do the same for The Traveler, El Caminante.
Cool, okay. Well, my first thought is, if I get the same kind of pickings that Nashi had of women, I'm going to cast myself. And the I'll actually not do that. No, actually,
in which role?
whichever one is there with the naked woman, and then just, you know. May play 10. Like, hey, Nashi played 4 or 5 roles in most of his.
I'm going to play all the male roles.
So, okay. No, actually, okay, so here we go. Starting with, of course, the most important character, Paul Nashi's character of Bernard de Fosse, who was the priest, the traveling high inquisitor. My thinking was, okay, I don't think it's important to find somebody that physically, you know, resembles Nashi. That's not important to me. And John Belushi's dead,
John Belushi's dead. I definitely am not going to go that route.
Yeah, where you're like, okay, they've got to look like.
Yeah, I don't know that they. Mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. having them look like the actor that played the mm-hmm. role in the first place is probably a mistake. So, right. Yeah.
So my thinking is, okay, so I'm not worried about a physical resemblance, Nashi, but I am wanting somebody who's. I want an actor who's okay. Not conventionally attractive, but not unattractive, you know, just like Nashi, you know, just, you know, attractive man, you know, not supermodel or not, you know, not perfect, you know, male lead looks. Somebody who can convey, I guess, somebody who has kind of a grizzled quality, can convey a certain weight, you know, and intensity. And the actor I came up with is a guy who's actually does have 100 credits to his title, but is only just now kind of starting to get some recognition, real recognition, is the actor John Hawkes. Who played, first started to come to attention playing the Jewish store owner in Deadwood, the sadly defunct, short-lived, died way before its time, HBO series Deadwood. He played Saul Starr. He's gotten most recognition for his role in Winter's Bone, which is a terrific film. If you haven't seen that, I actually think he was Oscar nominated for that.
I can't remember if he was, but his co-star Jennifer Lawrence certainly was.
Yeah, it's kind of the film that launched her, yeah, you know, yeah, kind of began to launch her career, and she is now a bona fide star. But yeah, so I picked, so John Hawks, I thought, can convey
good
that
choice,
that kind
good
of,
choice, because he's a hell of a good actor.
He really is. He really
yeah,
is.
Yeah, and I can see where you're talking about that. I mean, mm-hmm, he's a very different body type. He's a naturally thin man and can actually appear skeletal at times.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I can see him in that role. Good choice. Okay. Damn good choice.
Thank
that's good casting.
Thank
I agree. Yeah.
Now, I'm stepping way on a limb for the role of Catherine, who's the woman that he, of course, becomes infatuated with. I did really want a Spanish, a woman that looks, you know, Spanish. And
okay.
And I kind of wanted to go with somebody unknown and was really kind of struggling with it and, until I saw really where it kind of popped in places. And I know nothing about this actress or whether she's even any good, so this is why I'm really stepping out on a limb. But I kind of just like the presence that the Spanish actress they talk to a lot in the documentary, which is Laura DePedro is her name.
Oh, yeah.
She's apparently in Impusa with Paul Naschy, and she was also another Naschy connection. And she was in a film called, which I haven't seen, but it's called Diary of a Nymphomaniac, which was directed by Christian Molina, who directed Rojo Sangre.
Okay.
She doesn't have many credits to her title. To her name. I keep saying that, to her name. Doesn't have many titles to her name. But again, she's certainly beautiful, but I thought she just had a pleasing personality, a charming, you know, had some presence there even in her interviews, and just made me curious about, you know, again, like I said, you know, Elena might have seen her and say, she may chime back in and say like, no, she's terrible or whatever, but you know, but we haven't seen her anything, but that's actually who I would choose for the role of Catherine there. So,
okay. Interesting.
Now I'm going to do a little bit of Quentin Tarantino stunt casting here. I'm going to pull in a couple of names from Naschy's past here. I'm actually going to go and drag Julia Sally out of her restaurant. Even if I have to pull her by her amazing hair, I'm going to make her play Mabille, the witch, because remember, Julia Sally was in the original Inquisition as one of the young, I think, one of Catherine's sisters. And
yeah,
so now I would actually have her in the role of the village witch, which is Mabille.
Interesting. I
yeah,
like it.
My other bit of stunt casting is now, I couldn't find my notes from Inquisition, and I couldn't tell from looking at the IMDb if I've got all of these names associated with the right characters, but I think that Nicholas Rodier or Rodier or whatever, I believe was the character who was the older Inquisitor that traveled with. Remember, there was the older Inquisitor and the younger one that traveled with Bernard de Fosse.
Okay, well, that but
you
that
know the character I'm talking
in
about.
In that role, you
I would pick Jack Taylor, actually.
Oh, good choice, because having seen him in that documentary now, you know he's still alive and kicking.
Mm-hmm,
and
exactly.
And seems to be still
yeah,
full of vim and vigor.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
definitely would be somebody who could do a film now.
Yeah, who the guy who eventually kind of becomes Bernard de Fosse's condemner or whatever, or
yeah,
becomes it. So this leaves me two more roles. Again, I wasn't trying to cast every single person in the film, but just what he, you know, Dan was saying, the major roles. So I've got two more here. And the role of Emile, who was the intelligent, the voice of reason in the film, who was
uh-huh,
the person who was trying to talk sense to everybody in the film, the more progressive thinking person. I cast James Nesbitt, who's an Irish actor who...
Oh, Jekyll.
Yes. Now, he's very incredibly sinister and frightening as Jekyll, but as... I mean, as Hyde, but as Jekyll in this incredible series. Everybody needs to see it. If you haven't seen the British TV series, six-part Jekyll, you need to. It's fantastic. But the way he plays the character of Dr. Jekyll, or Jackman, I think they call him in the film, but James Nesbitt, I think he could really pull off a role of somebody who's a little more, you know, well-read, more sensitive, you know, more that kind of character, you know, who's kind of
yeah,
the voice of
yeah,
reason in there. So I think he's a really good actor. So I chose him for Emile. And one more part here, the part of Renover, who was the sort of the village thug, outcast, or the one who kind of informs on everybody and sort of always
yeah,
in the ear of the Inquisitors and basically makes everything go wrong for, you know, because he's felt, you know, shunned by the village and by the village women. I wanted somebody who could be rough enough in appearance, who could be seen as somebody who would be, you know, who the women would not maybe inherently not trust or kind of not be interested in, but who also could be charming enough to get the ear of the Inquisitors, you know, who could be to gain their trust. So I chose Ron Perlman for Renover.
Oh, good. Hey, I can see how that could work very easily.
Yeah, and so one more
I'm remembering, yeah, I'm remembering his role in Name of the Rose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Where we also exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I also went one more step further than what Dan had asked for. Is I'm actually choosing a director too.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so to direct it, I would have a guy who I've really only seen one of his films, but he's made a couple of others that I've heard are very good that I want to see. He's a Danish director, and his name is, and I may be pronouncing this wrong, it looks like Nicholas Winding Refn.
Oh, I know, yes.
Who did, now the films I haven't seen, he did Drive with Ryan Gosling, which I've heard is very good.
Which is extremely good.
He did a film called Bronson with Tom Hardy that I really
Which I still haven't seen, yes. Yeah.
But he did, the film that I have seen, and why I think he would be very good for this, is Valhalla Rising, which is a very dark, moody, grim film set in Viking age, also very mystical and surreal in a lot of parts too. And I think he could really, him doing a film set in the plague and the Inquisition, I really think that he could do a good job on it. So that's who I choose as a director.
That's a good choice for director, because right now, I just saw the trailer for that particular director's newest film, and damn, now I can't remember the name of it.
Well,
it has to do with some kind of underground fight thing.
Oh, yes, I've heard about this. Yeah, and also, I don't know if you know that he's the latest, I think, in the conveyor belt of directors that's set to do the Logan's Run remake, which was, you know, Bryan Singer at one point, and now apparently he's the most recently now to do the next
Logan's Run. And I'll just say again, I think I've said this publicly for years, I don't have a problem with somebody tackling Logan's Run again, because it'd be a new adaptation of the novel.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah.
Go do it. As much as I get a kick out of the 70s film with Michael York, I enjoy the hell out of it, but it's not
nearly a sacred cow. It's not.
Well, it's far from a sacred cow. And the novel, I think if someone was able to try to tackle the novel and do it, do the novel as straight off the page as they could do it and get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
I would be really, really happy with that. I'd love to see.
Yeah.
I would love for Logan's Run to have become something like Body Snatchers, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where, you know, every decade or two, we get another version of it. That would be great.
Yeah.
Because I think it's one of those stories that I think could be interpreted in new ways pretty regularly.
Right.
I like that. Yeah. I like the fact that I Am Legend has three official versions, and you know, maybe a couple of unofficial versions out there too.
Yeah.
I like that because I like seeing those really strong, really good stories tried again and again. I'd love to see somebody do Logan's Run like that. That's exciting.
Yeah.
But, I like your casting ideas.
No, thank you.
Sir.
Thank you.
I would have probably jumped in a different direction, but we'll play this again.
You do the El Caminante. We'll be interested to hear what you have.
Because I've got a few interesting out of the box ideas.
Good.
And
because the trick with that one, when I was thinking you were going to do that, I was thinking like, you know, it's like who besides like identifying who would be the handful of characters you'd cast, because there's so many characters and there's so many vignettes, you know, like who would be besides the obvious ones, you know, but say who would you choose to like really try and think hard about what actor you'd want to do that. So I'm looking forward to hearing what you come up with.
Well, you'll be surprised at where I put Fred Ward.
But I'll be happy because I love seeing Fred Ward everywhere, and wherever Fred Ward is a good thing. So.
It's not a bad thing ever. You're right. Okay, so what's next in the mailbag?
Yes, so next we have...
Oh, wait. First, thank you, Dan, for making a stretch beyond our normal bounds.
Right, yes. Don't ever do it again, but we thank you for... No, that was fun. We do appreciate that. We do appreciate that. It's always good to we do get too complacent with our own brilliance at times. And it's good to have somebody challenge us. So,
oh, God. Okay.
All right, this is from Mark. This is from Mark here. Thanks. Always good to hear from Mark. He says, hey, fellas. Many thanks for the latest Nashy Cast. I always enjoy the end of the world roundups, and I'd be particularly interested to hear your best to worst list of the Waldemar Daninsky films. Hopefully we'll get to hear that sometime soon. Not sure if you gents have mentioned this before, but I noticed recently that Assignment Terror has had a DVD release in Germany. Whilst there is no English soundtrack option, it does have English subs, which is good enough for me. Plus it comes in one of those groovy hard boxes which you only ever seem to get with German DVDs. It says again I have to wait until my birthday before I get my grubby mitts on it, but I'll let you know how it pans out. Do you know anything about that?
I've seen photographs. It's a bit too pricey for me.
Yeah.
I do have an all regions DVD player, so I would be able to watch it.
But pretty hefty.
Hefty price for a film that is not one of my favorite Nashies, I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Says Mark goes on to say, speaking of Spanish films on DVD, I recently bought a copy of Murder in a Blue World, aka Clockwork Terror. Don't know if either of you have seen it, but it's a futuristic thriller obviously influenced by Clockwork Orange. It's by no means a perfect film, but it's very enjoyable with a great ending. Director also made the excellent Cannibal Man and an obscure but enjoyable film called The Glass Ceiling. Once again, I'm not familiar with any of these.
Not at all familiar with this movie. Mm-hmm. And now I'm very curious because I'm a fan of Cannibal Man. I found it. I found Cannibal Man to be an incredibly strange. What year did Murder in the Blue World come out?
Well, it doesn't really say here, and no, just a second. We'll find out. To Love. It's got an alternate title, apparently. 1973.
Okay, 1973.
Also called To Love, Perhaps to Die.
To Love, Perhaps to Die. Okay. Who's
in this? Let's see what we can find out about here. Okay, so yeah, directed by De La Iglesia.
Sue Lyon, Christopher Mitchum.
All right, Christopher Mitchum. Yes.
Christopher Mitchum. Oh God, what's the plot?
Oh, look, Eduardo Calvo. There's a familiar name to Nashy fans.
True. It says set in the future, the story follows a nurse who tries to bring her own style of relief to people condemned to die. Her identity is a mystery, and she may not be quite what she seems. Okay, now I am intrigued.
Me too.
Murder in a Blue World is a film I'm going to have to check out.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, cool. Thank you. Neither of us have seen that one.
Yeah, so. Thanks for the tip there. Cool. Margo's going to say, many thanks to Troy for the heads up on the Red Riding trilogy. It's not something I'd heard of until you mentioned it, but it sounds excellent. I've got the Blu-ray in my Amazon wish list. Typically, there isn't a UK Blu-ray, so I've opted for the US release. The only choice I have to make now is whether to read the books first, which also look excellent. Yeah, I haven't read the books, but I thoroughly enjoyed that trilogy. It's just really well done. Lots of great British actors in it. Really, really dark, unsettling films. Very good. You said you've not seen those, right?
I have not either, no.
Yeah, very good stuff. This is a good one. Mark says, I also noticed there's a new Bloody Pit that must have passed me by. Just as a little heads up, who the hell is Sergeant Preston of the Yukon?
you skipped a paragraph, but
I did. I'm sorry.
Hold on. I'll answer the question. Who the hell is Sergeant Yukon? Yes, folks, I did a brief podcast for the Bloody Pit.
Mm-hmm.
During the winter months, I get nostalgic for things that happened way before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those things is old-time radio shows, and one of my favorite old-time radio shows is an adventure series called either Challenge of the Yukon or Sergeant Preston of the Yukon, and it's this long-running series that also became a TV series in the 50s about a Royal Canadian Mounted policeman. And I decided to do a brief episode letting that freak flag fly, essentially, about Sergeant Preston of the Yukon. So if you have any questions about Sergeant Preston or anything like that, you can listen to episode number 6 of The Bloody Pit. I give you some information about the radio show, the TV show, a few clips from the TV show, and then I include an episode of a 15-minute long episode of the radio show from, I think, the mid-40s to give you a taste of what the thing is like. And I don't expect it to be a show that suddenly sends millions of people to go running off to check out Sergeant Preston of the Yukon, and suddenly there's a resurgence of interest in the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
I was going to say, you must feel intimidated by knowing all the thousands of Royal Canadian Mounted podcasts out there. And there must have been.
Yes. I did a thorough search, and I may end up in the top 10 of that just with this one podcast. But anyway,
okay. Yeah, everybody check out Sergeant Preston. Believe me, it's not your father's Dudley Do-Right.
So it's your grandfather's.
It's your grandfather's Dudley Do-Right. That's right. All right. So yes, the paragraph I skipped. Sorry, Mark. He says, very much looking forward to your next Nashy cast. I wanted to see The Man Who Saw Frankenstein Cry for a long time now. Hopefully, it's as good as we all want it to be. I believe it's available as an extra on the Spanish Blu-ray of one of Nashy's more recent films, but I'm not sure if it has English subs. And that's interesting. I didn't know.
Yes, it is available as an extra on the Spanish Blu-ray of Valdemar Legacy.
Valdemar Inheritance or Legacy.
Valdemar Inheritance or Legacy.
Oh, so it's on that. That's interesting.
I can't remember if it's on the Blu-ray of the first or the second, or maybe it's in that two-pack. I can't remember, but that's how it's legally available, at least in Spain.
Okay.
But it has not been released in the States or in England from, at least as far as I'm aware so far.
Okay.
So,
okay.
That is your legal option for seeing it. Hopefully, it will get a release over here.
Yes.
And because I really would love to have a really great copy of it to be able to show people who are curious about what in the hell have you spent 3 years of your life talking about.
Yeah. And like you said, maybe just have access to more interviews too, you know, so that's what we hope for.
The extras on a DVD release, that would be amazing.
Yep.
Yes. Okay, we've got, is this our last? We've got one more. Yeah, we've got one more piece of email here. From Richard, who he's the co-host of Hello, It's the Doomed Show.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He's the Richard portion of that show. Mm-hmm. He says, okay, Rod and Troy, a.k.a. Troy Radio, where he took the letters of our names and kind of rammed them together. I think he's trying to create some kind of troglodyte.
I was going to say that, or maybe he's just imagining, like, after the thing, you know, John Carpenter, like the classic thing, you know, creature gets a hold of us and something goes horribly wrong and we just become this merged, you know, sort of thing.
This merged beast critter, yes. Okay, he says, I was avoiding listening to the Crimes of Patois episode because I wanted to see the movie first, and I totally missed you guys reading my email. Brad, my podcasting partner in crime, informed me that you guys had some awesome things to say about my Franco Friday series. So I just listened to the show and was slapping my forehead. So I'm sorry that I am just responding now to your Franco-related inquiry. First of all, thanks for the plug on my blog. Since I wrote into you, I have slowly started up the Franco Friday series again. I have now reviewed 37 Jess Franco films, through, though the series is anything but weekly. I thought, rather foolishly, that I had seen everything I wanted to see from the old scoundrel. My goal is 52 films, then I might seriously consider seeing a physician, or a psychiatrist, or taking another break.
But just remember that if they look like Jess Franco, you're in trouble.
And if their name is Orloff, you want to run. Yeah,
that's right.
But if you've seen 37 wow. Franco films by now, you already know to run away from anyone named Orloff. So.
Yeah.
He says, so what kind of Franco films do I like? Censored ones. What? He says, I recently did the opposite of what Tim Lucas did, according to his blog, and skipped the HD presentation of Female Vampire completely. Instead, I watched a compressed and chopped up rip of the film under its Erotokill VHS title, and I loved it. I'm only being half contrary here. Believe it or not, I prefer censored Jess Franco to endless shots of lady parts, or even worse, porno inserts cut in by some idiotic distributor. My unwillingness to sit through Eurosex romps really is that strong. We'll take a pause here and say, with Female Vampire, I have only ever seen the full-length Female Vampire edit of the film. The Erotokill version is one that I might be coerced into watching because, as I said, you could chop a good 30 minutes without even trying out of the Female Vampire cut and not lose an instance of anything valuable.
Yeah.
I mean, I like watching Lena Romay ride on a bed nude as much as the next guy, but after a little while, I'm ready for something else. So I understand where you're coming from, Richard. I really do. I won't say that about a lot of his films, at least not the ones that I immediately enjoyed, but I know where you're coming from. Because the censored / recut edited version of A Virgin Among the Living Dead is a fucking god-awful thing to see.
Yes, it is, yeah.
But back to Richard's email. I lean more towards the wacky and accidentally beautiful side of Jess Franco. Give me something like Kiss Me Monster. Between the intentional humor, unintentionally bad dubbing, idiotic attempts at sexiness, etc., there is a raving imagination behind it all. I love the dark side of Franco, which is why I love Eugenia Desade so much. Had the same film been made in the late 70s, it would have been shit. Its subject is macabre, but it holds back on the endless shots of feminine mechanics that plague almost all of his work with Lena Romay. When it comes to his sexy side, I prefer something as hilariously grotesque as Blue Rita, which is one of the weirdest things I have ever seen. Ever. I have to admit, I haven't seen Blue Rita yet. I have a copy of it, but I've not watched Blue Rita yet, so can't comment on Blue Rita, but I know where you're coming from on the Franco thing. Let me finish his email, and then we'll get to that. As for what I would recommend to a hypothetical person who is new to the world of Franco, right off the top of my head, if they are a slasher fan, then Bloody Moon is the easy recommend, and or Faceless for Gorehounds. For an adventurous Euro-horror fanatic, Vampires Lesbos is the first thing that comes to mind. Venus in Furs is the second. If you have some people over and you want to blow their minds, or your own, right out the back of their dang skulls, then throw on Rites of Frankenstein without any kind of warning. They may never speak to you again, but honestly, who wants friends?
Yeah.
They're overrated, aren't they? Richard, P.S., he says, thank you for continuing to support Hello, This is a Doom Show. Well, you don't have to thank us for that. That's not a problem. Stuff. I haven't listened to their new episode.
Yeah, no, I'm interested to hear what their take on. I haven't heard their take yet on Franco's passing, you know, to see what they if they have anything special planned.
Yeah,
for
yeah.
That.
Their new episode focuses on slashers from 1981.
Cool.
And I have not listened to that. I have not listened to that as yet. I did enjoy the episode right before that quite a bit, but haven't listened to the new one yet. The and I say that, and now that of course that I've said that up, by the time this show goes up, I'll have listened to it because I'll have felt guilty about not having listened to it yet. But as for Franco, I mean, I've talked a little bit about the fact that Franco and I, as people, he and I shared common interest of an odd bent. He and I both obviously loved Pulp Fiction,
right?
From what would have been his childhood, and of course that area of things I'm nostalgic for that happened way before I was ever born.
Yeah.
But his love of Pulp Fiction and various things of that type. When that interest of his crosses over into his filmmaking and he's able to do that kind of thing, those are the kind of movies that I really feel like I lock into a groove with him on. So for me, as much as I can enjoy, I think Eugenia Desade is a good film. I did enjoy it. Nightmare Comes at Midnight is one that I really enjoyed. Venus and Furs, I didn't.
I know I liked that a little more than I liked a little more than you did. Yeah, right. I remember that. Yeah, we've talked about that before.
But Lucky the Inscrutable, I dearly loved because it is an incredibly funny movie, intentionally funny. It's kind of a Euro spy comedy. Lucky the Inscrutable is brilliant. The Girl from Rio, I enjoyed the hell out of.
Now, one I really really liked, but I get confused. I have to always straight clear this up because. Which is the one, because he made actually two films called Eugenie, right?
Yes, yes.
The one that had, I don't think I've seen them both, but the one that I have seen and really, really liked was the one with Christopher Lee in it. That's not Eugenie Desade.
No, that's a different film.
And I really like that one a lot.
Yeah, that's...
The story of her descent.
Story like, of her awakening.
Or something.
Yeah. And I like that one okay too, but I like Eugenie Desade better. Yeah. Also like 99 Women. And,
yeah, I like that.
Yeah, 99 Women was very good. I like Barbed Wire Dolls. Mm. Doriana Gray was actually interesting, and I even I would point to the kind of porn. Actually, the porn version of that I think is actually a better film than a kind of a cut down version of it. But there are a lot of Franco films that I really really enjoy. Night of the Skulls is one of those that he made in the 70s that really pushes all those pulp.
Yeah.
Old Dark House buttons for me, and I really, really enjoy it.
Yeah, I enjoyed Night of the Skulls, too.
But it's when his interests and mine overlap, or those are the films that I find myself locking into a groove on. And, you know, I think most people who enjoy his cinema can groove heavily on a lot of the stuff from the 70s, the Red Lips films like Kiss Me Monster or Awful Dr. Orloff or Diabolical Dr. Z. Those are just really great films. It really kind of depends. What's neat about Franco is that you can have something like The Bloody Judge, which is really kind of straightforward. One of his Fu Manchu movies that he did for Harry Allen Towers. Right next to something like She Killed in Ecstasy, and
which I really enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah, I like that one a lot too.
But I totally know what he. I get the point of what he's making about the nudity and stuff because like now a lot of times if we're glad to see that something is the uncut or version or has nudity, and a lot of times it's just because you know we love to know that we're seeing an uncut version of a film.
Well, it's not been taken out of the creator's hands and shortened or chopped away at just because somebody had some kind of different idea about you know how to make more money from it. So.
Yeah, but there's definitely it can be said that eroticism that is filmed without any kind of art at all or you know that's just mechanically. Yeah. Just boringly filmed, and a lot of times Franco can be accused of being guilty of that. And a lot of Euro films can be. I mean, let's face it. I mean, even the Nashi films we've done for all the loads and loads of beautiful women that are in them. You know, there's not been a whole lot of lovemaking scenes that we have. You know, normally you were saying like, well, this is the typical mechanical. Yeah. You know, someone lying on top of the other. You know, they have very few of them are very artfully or erotically filmed.
Agreed.
And that's, you know, so you run into that a lot in Euro horror, and certainly Franco, could some of his films could achieve a certain you know, erotic tension or erotic feeling at some, but there's a lot of them that just don't, where you're just like, okay, get on with it. You know, so I totally can see what he's
I'm impressed by anybody who can honestly claim that they sat through the full-length version of Female Vampire without leaning on the fast-forward button at times.
It
drove me crazy.
Yeah.
Completely crazy. But, with that said, we will be covering at least a couple more Franco films before the year is out, and I think that... I think maybe I'm gonna go out of my way to try to choose films from very different eras. Maybe one from the 60s and maybe one from the 80s, because the ones we've covered so far have all been in the 70s.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So I think I'm gonna shake us out of that
a
little bit, and I think that the next we'll cover a 60s or an 80s Franco film, and that'll kind of shake us up and make us look at things in a little bit different light. So I think that'll be fun.
Yeah, it will. Well, cool.
All right. Well, then I guess that's it for the mailbag right now. And I feel safe in saying that the mailbag section of this may have been longer than our discussion of the film.
Well, but maybe people were listening to our "Woe is us, please mail us." You know, before like, you know,
they may have. They certainly responded. That's
yes,
for sure.
They did. Well, thank you, and thank you to everybody for pitching in, joining in, helping us to extend the show, because it was in danger of being the shortest episode ever. And all of that. That was good. That was, and so. Yes, please keep sending the messages to nashycast@gmail.com or on Facebook.
Yep. Visit us over on the Facebook page if you'd like.
Mm-hmm. Continue to read Rod's blog at the Bloody Pit of Rod and support his separate podcast there, his Bloody Pit of Rod podcast.
Thank you very much. And I guess what we'll say is next time out for our next episode here in about a month, we are going to leap feet first back into the Nashy filmage.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to finally cover A Dragonfly for Each Corpse.
Mm-hmm.
It's a movie that both of us have watched before. We know this film. We have watched it before. And I think actually we watched it together.
Several years ago.
This will be my first return visit to the film, so it's going to be interesting. We're going to finally talk about Dragonfly for Each Corpse.
And that is this our last Klimovsky? That is Klimovsky, right, or not? Am I right about
Darn,
it?
You know.
We'll find out. Yep, it is.
Oh, yeah, it is.
And I'm wondering maybe our last Klimovsky Nashy. I don't know if there's others that I don't know if there's something we hadn't got our hands on yet, or somewhere. This may be our last Klimovsky Nashy combo.
I think it may be. Don't quote me on it.
We could be wrong about that.
A little excited. Paul Nashy and Erica Blank.
Yeah, I love Erica Blank.
Yeah, it'll give us a chance to talk about other Erica Blank films.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes.
Devil's Nightmare.
As I say, Devil's Nightmare is one of my favorites. I love Devil's Nightmare.
Oh yeah. Cool. But so next time out, we will talk about A Dragonfly for Each Corpse. If you can get your hands on that one, I can't remember how hard it is get your hands on A Dragonfly for Each Corpse.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's what we'll be covering next time. Thank you very much for tuning in and listening.
Yes.
And remember what we're going to end the podcast with is that tune from the Screaming Witch Doctors.
Yeah.
This is an homage to Paul Nashy. Listen to it, and if you enjoy it, seek them out. I found I found their new album on, and this is off their new album. I found it on Amazon.com, of all places. So,
cool.
Check it out, folks, and we will talk to you next time. I am Rod Barnett.
I'm Troy Gwynn.
Have fun, folks.